You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's show, I'm joined by Matthew Jamieson and George Brock, who'll be giving us their views and analysis on some of the biggest stories of the day. Among them, of course, events in Crimea and the somewhat different take that the Russian media provides.
The Russian president has not made a final decision on whether to send in the military, saying this would only be a choice of last resort. But to judge by the mainstream media, however, it's as if Crimea has been swarming with Russian forces for days.
Who'd have thought? That was, of course, RT. We'll also be discussing Hugo Chavez's lasting influence on Venezuelan politics on the anniversary of his death. And we'll decide whether a tabloid entirely devoted to Pope Francis is a good or a bad thing. I'm slightly agnostic. A little later in the show, we'll ask if Italy's new government may be able to save one of the greatest world sites that it's falling into decay. That's Pompeii. And
you've got to join our male strip group.
A new production of The Full Monty begins in London. Matt Wolfe from the International New York Times will give us his rundown of his London theatre picks.
It's not quite as hysterical an atmosphere as there was at the stage version of Dirty Dancing, but it does kind of whip the audience into a frenzy, but I think at this point it's a manageable frenzy.
A manageable frenzy, and that's what we're aiming for here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. And to get us underway, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Diplomatic efforts to end the crisis in Ukraine are being stepped up, with the US Secretary of State John Kerry meeting his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Paris. A standoff continues in Crimea, where Russian forces remain in de facto control of that part of the Ukrainian state. Well, Mr. Kerry says there's still a way to avoid a deeper crisis.
The United States of America would prefer to see this de-escalated. We would prefer to see this managed through the structures of legal institutions, international institutions that we've worked many years in order to be able to deal with this kind of crisis.
Meanwhile, we're getting news that a Ukrainian air defense base in Cape Fiolent near Sevastopol has just surrendered to Russian armed men who threatened to destroy the base if they refused to give up their weapons. The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has welcomed Japan's resumption of economic activities with Iran under an interim nuclear deal as the West eases a year-long stranglehold on revenues that has crippled the Iranian economy. Sanctions over the past 2 years have cut Iran's oil exports in half, while US measures stop the remaining importers of Iranian oil from transferring cash to Tehran, starving Iran of hard currency and forcing it to the negotiating table over its disputed nuclear program. The trial of three Al Jazeera journalists is resuming in Egypt. Six more are being tried in their absence, among a total of 20 accused of helping the Muslim Brotherhood, banned by Egypt's military rulers as a terrorist group. Well, Brett Mason, a correspondent for Australia's SBS, has recently returned from Cairo.
I think today is going to be very, very critical. If we don't see the case either thrown out or Peter Greste and the others released on bail, then I think huge alarm bells should be ringing in the international media community. The hope is that the judge has gone away, he's looked at that file, and he may have made a decision based on that.
Here, Rupert Murdoch's former British newspaper boss, Rebecca Brooks, denied on Wednesday that she was part of a cover-up to conceal the extent of phone hacking at one of his tabloids, but agreed she had paid £1 million to buy the silence of one outraged victim. Brooks, who ran News Corp's British arm, News International, in 2011, denies charges of conspiracy to hack phones, authorising illegal payments to public officials, and conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. US President Barack Obama proposed new tax credits and job training programs for US workers in a 2015 budget. His plan is all but certain to be rejected by the Republican-controlled House of Representatives and stands little chance of passage. But Obama unveiled the document during a visit to a local elementary school.
Our budget is about choices. It's about our values. As a country, we've got to make a decision if we're going to protect tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans or if we're going to make smart investments necessary to create jobs and grow our economy and expand opportunity for every American. At a time when our deficits are falling at the fastest rate in 60 years, we've got to decide if we're going to keep squeezing the middle class or if we're going to continue to reduce the deficits responsibly.
And finally, a British survey on mobile phone etiquette has found that Londoners had the worst phone manners, while the Scots were found to be the most polite. The study found the Welsh, surprisingly, are the worst for leaving it over a week to text someone back about a date, and the West Midlands is most prone to taking selfies. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
As a proud Brummie, Jonathan Wheatley, I'm not entirely sure what to make of that. But anyway, Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. 1806 here in London, 1306 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. This is Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Joining me now with their take on the news of the day is Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at RUSI here in London, and George Brock, head of journalism at City University. George, Matthew, welcome to the programme. Obviously, our starting point today is Ukraine, indeed Crimea. And today we wanted to take a little look at the way the crisis is being covered by our friends in Moscow at RT, formerly Russia Today. It's fair to say they see things a little differently than the West. For example, on that issue of whether Russian troops are actually in Crimea.
Right now we're inside one of the camps organized by one of the so-called self-defense units right here in the capital of the Crimea. They've been, for the past week, keeping the streets safe, protecting the local population. Let's just meet with these guys, find out who they are. Dobrый день.
Hello, what's your name?
My name is Edgar.
Where are you from?
I'm a local from Simferopol, Crimea.
How long have you been in this camp?
The camp has been here for 11 days now.
What's your purpose?
Our goal is to maintain the peace in Crimea.
Did you self-organize or you're under some sort of command?
We have people who are in senior command positions, but we organized all of this ourselves.
How many others like you are here in the city?
There are a lot of people like us in the city.
Did you see any Russian soldiers here or military hardware?
I honestly haven't. This is a funny question, actually. There are people dressed like me in the city who are in the same defense groups and who keep law and order here.
What made you go out onto the streets and protect the locals?
I was motivated by the events in Kyiv. I've seen it all with my own eyes. I saw soldiers beaten in the Mariinsky Park. I felt I had to do this out of civic responsibility.
Thanks a lot. We won't keep you any longer.
George Brock, that's journalism at its finest there. They are simply showing a side that the Western media refuses to show, aren't they?
No, they're not. They're showing a highly selected set of events and people. And there was an extraordinary thing on RT where there was a lady basically complaining about the international media coverage of what's happening in the Crimea. She was saying that, for example, there weren't Russian troops in the Crimea. Behind her, the screen was actually showing pictures of film being run by people like CNN, which showed precisely that there were Russian troops there. It reaches a kind of, the whole thing reaches a rather surreal level, actually.
Matthew Jameson, Vladimir Putin, and today we heard from Sergei Lavrov as well, saying, you know, there's really no troops there. I don't know what all this is about. There does seem to be a willingness amongst some people to not believe what they can actually see in front of their own eyes.
Yes, I mean, if you were to take Mr. Putin and Mr. Lavrov's comments at face value, you would have to suspend your sense of disbelief actually believe what they're saying is true. I mean, it's nonsense. It's errant nonsense. And it's also an insult to other people's intelligence, but they don't really care about that. They've been very clever because if you look at a lot of the soldiers that are operating in Crimea that are from Russia or certainly have been instigated on behalf of the Kremlin, some of them don't have insignia, some of them aren't wearing uniform. So this has been a very clever ploy by the Kremlin. But there's no doubt whatsoever that these are Russian forces operating in the Crimean Peninsula.
George Brock, RT of tapped into something here, though, haven't they? Generally, if you look at the way they cover things, they are very much anti-Western or anti-Western government. They've covered the Occupy protests around the world in a way that other Western media outlets were perhaps slower to do. They've got a position, but they'll say others have a position and we're providing a counterbalance.
Oh, look, I mean, they've tapped into a very big wave of change, both RT and China Television, and China Television may become the world's largest newsroom in time. That title is still held by the BBC at the moment, but the Chinese are trying to overtake it. And they are offering different perspectives. They are saying to people, you don't like the official established media in your own country, the big TV networks, you can have another view. These are now very easy to get via satellite and cable, and that's the kind of wave on which these change have established themselves. But I don't actually think in the long run their claim to tell anybody anything really useful is going to be held up by events like the Ukraine. They are in a terrible, actually, if you step back from it, they are in a most terrible bind. You know, an anchor woman on RT actually said on the air the other day, I think what Russia has done is completely wrong.
She did, yes. She was also, it turns out, actually a 9/11 truther and has some interesting things to say about Israel. But I mean, yeah, we'll get on to the Westerners working for RT in a moment. But Matthew Jameson, this sort of the way that they approach news, the way that RT approaches news, it's interesting that they were called Russia Today. They've dropped that. They are just now RT, and they don't necessarily sell themselves as the voice of Russia. They're quite careful at not doing that and having English or American front people and saying, look, we're just the alternative to the traditional media, to the mainstream media.
Well, yes, I mean, they are quite clever and wily in how they present themselves and their marketing and their packaging. But, you know, you scratch beneath the surface and who was it who actually conceived of RT? The people, the brains behind it, were actually, ironically, the Kremlin's media minister and Vladimir Putin's former press spokesperson came up with the whole idea. It is, in actual fact, a government-conceived and almost government-run media organization. Most of its funding comes from the Kremlin or from Kremlin-friendly banks and companies. And quite frankly, as I was saying with George earlier, there really is no freedom of press in Russia in terms of how we understand it in the liberal West, in this country. They don't have the same culture of freedom of expression, freedom of press, and they certainly don't have the rule of law that we do. So, RT is, quite frankly, just a mouthpiece for the state.
George, you obviously teach at City University, you teach journalism. If any of your students were to say to you, I've been offered a job at RT, they say they're not going to interfere, you know, they'll pay me quite well, they'll allow me to do some interesting things, what would you say to them?
Well, firstly, I'd play them the coverage from the Ukraine. And secondly, I'd say, well, you shouldn't take all these claims at face value. Because plainly, they're not true. These are state, exactly as Matthew says, these are state-inspired TV perspectives. You can't stop it happening. They have the resources to do it. But in the end, that credibility will get undermined. And I think in the case of RT, it's been badly shot by what's happened in the Ukraine, and it may be about to get worse.
But, some people have described them as a sort of an anti-Fox. And yet, because there are lots of similarities, they just obviously take the opposite view. Would you have similar concerns with your students working at Fox, which, although not taking a line from a government, they certainly, it could be argued, take a pretty strong editorial line on certain issues?
I think that's slightly different. I mean, I think there is a big difference between taking part in a government-sponsored operation and a private TV operation which has strong opinions. The basic driver of change here is that now many, many more people can be TV broadcasters than there were before. If you don't have a broadcasting oligopoly as we had in the previous generation, but you now have, it's now very cheap to start a satellite or cable TV station as it is basically all over the world, you're going to get TV stations with opinions. The key is not that they've got opinions. The key is, are they concealing where the opinions come from? The problem with China TV or Press TV from Iran or RT is that they are not straight about where their support and those opinions and their editorial line come from. If you're watching Fox, it's pretty clear what's happening.
The big news story on RT today is actually become a big news story everywhere, and it's a leaked tape of a telephone conversation between the Estonian Foreign Minister Umez Pate and EU Foreign Affairs Chief Catherine Ashton, in which Pate says that he believes that the Ukrainian opposition, as was, hired the snipers in Kiev that were pictured shooting at protesters a couple of weeks ago. We have a clip of that tape now.
All the evidence shows that people who were killed by snipers from both sides, among policemen and people from the streets, that they were the same snipers killing people from both sides.
Well, that's...
So that, and then she also showed me some photos. She said that has medical doctor. She can, you know, say that it is the same handwriting, the same type of bullets. And it's really disturbing that now the new coalition, that they don't want to investigate what exactly happened. So that there is now stronger and stronger understanding that behind snipers, it was not Yanukovych, but it was somebody from the new coalition.
You can almost hear Catherine Ashton rolling her eyes as Pate is talking there. Matthew, you actually had Foreign Minister Pate on the Monocle Daily last night, and he was certainly seems to be saying something different in public. This tape, it must be said, is the recording is from about 10 days ago, I think. It's certainly not recent, though. It's obviously just come out now. The fact that this has, and we'll talk about substance in a moment, but the fact that this has been leaked to RT, what does that tell you about the way the Kremlin is viewing the media game right now?
It tells you that the Kremlin is very active in all types of skullduggery and espionage to twist and distort communications that should be private. These are actually private diplomatic conversations between very high-ranking government officials. And it's very curious how this is the second time in a matter of weeks that this has occurred, that lo and behold, out of the blue, someone has somehow picked up and bugged conversations between Victoria Nuland, that's a very senior State Department official, and now the Estonian foreign minister. And again, lo and behold, they appear on the internet with crystal clear reception. Quite frankly, I think that we all understand who's doing this. The FSB are obviously tapping and monitoring these communications and using them for their own purposes. May I say also that the Estonian Foreign Minister I saw today, he has said that that conversation, when put in context, was a discussion of the various theories, conspiracy theories floating around in Kiev about all sorts of things. And you must remember, there's a lot of confusion in these times of uprisings and a state of revolutionary chaos. A lot of Chinese whispers, a lot of people saying different things. Also, the doctor that he refers to, actually, she has just told the Britain's Telegraph that she didn't actually have any access to those who were shot from the government side, and she wouldn't be able to verify how those people on the government side were killed. So it's all very dubious.
George Brock.
Like Matthew, I was really struck by the quality of the audio. That was not done by amateurs.
No.
That much is completely clear.
And it's good to have seen such a... Everyone appears to be outraged, don't they? These things have been leaked in exactly the same way that everyone was outraged about the NSA spying on Angela Merkel.
The extract we heard doesn't tell you anything more than a couple of politicians basically gossiping about what they've heard. But, you know, when the FSB are listening to the phones, you've got to be really careful what you say.
And do you think the fact that, yeah, as we say, this is the second time this has happened in a matter of weeks, and obviously given the revelations about what the NSA may or may not be listening to, do diplomats, Matthew, do they now just accept that everything I write and everything I say at any stage, someone probably somewhere is listening or is able to access this?
Well, I think they do have to bear that in mind, and you have to take precautions. It's a terrible situation to be put in because, as I've said previously, diplomacy and international relations and certain business in government, sometimes it does require privacy, and you cannot sometimes conduct all these things out in the public for every Tom, Dick and Harry to be able to listen to and so on. You need to have a discretion, and you need to be able to have frank and full discussions behind closed doors, especially for diplomats. And so I think that this is a terrible violation, and there needs to be some kind of etiquette and conventions here respected, or else it's just going to be a free-for-all.
I think it's a free-for-all already. but don't forget that sometimes these things backfire. When WikiLeaks dumped into public literally hundreds of thousands of U.S. State Department cables of a rather more routine kind, and very few of them did really direct damage, an awful lot of them actually showed that what American diplomats were doing was exactly what they said they were doing, and they were doing it quite well. Who knew? It was a kind of back, it blew back.
We'll leave it there for a moment. We're with Matthew Jameson and George Brock. In a moment, we'll be talking about Venezuela, BuzzFeed, and a new tabloid magazine, which you'll all want to buy, I'm sure. You're listening to Midori House.
From cotton fields in Egypt to state-of-the-art laboratories in Bergamo, Monocle's film search for Made in Italy textiles focuses on the fifth-generation heritage firm Albini.
There is all this passion for excellence which comes from our art, from our landscape. There is really a typical Italian way of seeing things with passion for what is beautiful. And we have this in our soul. When customers see Made in Italy, they really must be sure that behind there are all these values.
The Fabric Mill, part of our Italian industry special, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm with George Brock from City University here in London and Matthew Jameson from RUSI. As we were saying a little earlier, today marks the first anniversary of the death of Hugo Chavez. The commemoration will no doubt be eventful as the political crisis continues in Venezuela, and protesters have already announced that they will march to disrupt the events planned by the government. But today is perhaps also a reminder for President Nicolas Maduro that he is not his predecessor, and that he may not have the charisma to keep the nation together as inflation rises and the shortages continue. Matthew, let me come to you first. It's been a year of Maduro, and he's marking that year in a difficult place at the moment, with these protests not necessarily on the front pages at the moment because of everything in the East, but it's certainly shaken things up in Venezuela.
Yes, absolutely. I think it seems to be quite interesting that it's almost a kind of a social divide as well. The younger people, and maybe more of the more aspirational or mobile, socially mobile people, are really up in arms. But if you go to some of the quarters with lower income groups, there's still a very warm feeling in terms of the legacy of Chavez, and then also what the current government, the socialist government, are trying to do. But it's clear that there is a deep sense of unrest, and it's going to be very interesting to see whether this takes off in the same way that events in Egypt and Ukraine and elsewhere have been over the last few years.
George Brock, this is... I can struggle to think of many political stories, geopolitical stories, that seem to be so difficult for Western media to cover. It's you're either on one side or the other, or it's you accuse a newspaper or a media outlet of being on one side or another. It is remarkably polarized, is it not?
It is, but the principal polarizing force about the coverage of Venezuela is the Venezuelan government itself. And Maduro is in a corner, and the lesson of this story is never succeed an incompetent but charismatic revolutionary. People are extremely tired and fed up.
I'll make sure I never do that.
Yeah, exactly. Don't do that. People are extremely fed up and tired with the economic policies. They've had, Chavez was there for, I think, was in power, I think, for 12 or 14 years. People are bored, they're fed up, and they have discovered that Maduro isn't the same person. He doesn't hold that same grip. He doesn't have that same grip on the public imagination. But don't forget that in countries like Venezuela, the police can be, and indeed the paramilitaries, can be pretty brutal. They killed three people in the demonstrations in February the 12th, and if it gets out of hand, you have to assume that they're liable to do that again.
Let's turn now to two different media stories. We'll come on to the most exciting one in a moment. But first of all, BuzzFeed, the CEO of BuzzFeed, Jonah Peretti, has today written a long letter to his staff, which has been made public, where he compares his company to the biggest names in media, New York Times, CBS and Time magazine. Indeed, he says that BuzzFeed is actually very similar to Time because they both like lists. George Brock, Peretti says that he believes that BuzzFeed can become a great enduring company of this new era. Do you think he's right?
I think there's quite a strong possibility he's right. I was writing a book about digital media. I was finishing it about a year ago.
Is it all out of date already?
No, it's not out of date at all. It explains a lot of the background, but I rather wish I'd written even more about BuzzFeed than I did. I talked about BuzzFeed in the book. But one of the things I said was there is a regular cycle in media whereby new stuff starts up using opportunities made by changes in technology. Established journalists all go, ugh, as they, and when BuzzFeed began, they said, huh, more buzz than feed. No real, you know, no real journalistic nutrition here. But as these sites grow up, they get better. They hire serious reporters. They start writing at length, which is exactly what BuzzFeed is doing. When I read this passage in Peretti's memo, I could have gone to New York and hugged him because it's exactly, he's proving exactly my point. You just have these regular cycles whereby newcomers, they start, they look like newcomers, they look like infants, and whoa, suddenly they're adults.
Matthew Jameson, I mean, to go back to our original discussion on Russia and Ukraine, you know, if this had happened 2 years ago, I don't think you would have been bookmarking BuzzFeed as a place to get your news or analysis. But on the big stories now, BuzzFeed is providing some fantastic journalism.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great in the sense that, you know, the more, you know, flowers that bloom in this great media landscape that provide really good, quick, efficient, digestible news, because there's so much going on in the world these days and constantly from so many different angles that you really do need to have that sort of quick, accessible sort of lists and clippings. I mean, BuzzFeed, I think, is very good. Also, Real Clear Politics and Politico as well. And it is that sense that actually, I think, I mean, it's correct, you know, as George said, they grow up and we are seeing a complete transformation in the media, newspaper and television sort of landscape.
And let's look at the newest pretender to the throne in the media landscape. It's just been released today on Ash Wednesday, as I'm sure mm-hmm. you're aware. That is a new tabloid devoted to all things papal. It's called Il Mio Papa. It's a 68-page weekly bonanza of pretty much everything you need to know, or perhaps didn't know you need to know, about Pope Francis. It's being published by Berlusconi's media empire, Mondadori. George Brock, are you going to be a subscriber to Il Mio Papa?
My Italian isn't really good enough, but I agree with you.
But you like the
Steve,
pictures.
The pictures will be absolutely wonderful, and it is a major publishing event. I mean, there aren't many people in the world who are so famous that they can effectively have a Hello magazine devoted at 68 pages a time to themselves.
There's Oprah, and now there seems to be the Pope.
Yeah, well, that's Oprah. A pretty small select group, you'd agree.
Indeed. Matthew, this couldn't have... if they tried to do this 2 years ago, I doubt Il Mio Papa, the Benedict edition, would have gone down well, would it?
No, I mean, certainly not. I think that, first of all, I think, as George says, I mean, this speaks to the power power of the Roman Catholic Church and its following, which is huge, and you know, it has a massive constituency around the world. And to be able to put out something like this around one person, 68 pages a week?
Allegedly. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many of those are going to be pictures.
Gosh, you know, I mean, certainly I think with Benedict, it would have been quite a different story. It's, you know, because Pope Francis, he has been a breath of fresh air this year, and the consensus is that, you know, he's come in and he started to shake things up a little bit. He started to move away from the more harsh hardline rhetoric that we were getting from the former authorities on things like homosexuality and so on. And he's taking a more kind of humble approach. So, I think it couldn't have probably taken off as it has 2 years ago.
There we are, two new subscribers, George Brock and Matthew Jameson. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots more still to come in the second half hour of Midori House. We'll look at the latest plays here in London, possibly even musicals too. And we'll also be in Italy as well as Madrid. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Diplomatic efforts to end the crisis in Ukraine are being stepped up, with the US Secretary of State John Kerry meeting his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Paris. A standoff continues in Crimea, where Russian forces remain in de facto control of that part of the Ukrainian state. The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has welcomed Japan's resumption of economic activities with Iran under an interim nuclear deal, as the West eases a year-long stranglehold on revenues that has crippled the Iranian economy. Sanctions over the past 2 years have cut Iran's oil exports in half. The trial of three Al Jazeera journalists is resuming in Egypt. Six more are being tried in their absence, among a total of 20 accused of helping the Muslim Brotherhood, banned by Egypt's military rulers as a terrorist group. And Rupert Murdoch's former British newspaper boss, Rebecca Brooks, denied today that she was part of a cover-up to conceal the extent of phone hacking at one of his tabloids, but agreed she had paid £1 million to buy the silence of one outraged victim. Brooks denies charges of conspiracy to hack phones, authorising illegal payments to public officials, and conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. To Madrid now, where the editor of Spain's second biggest newspaper has recently left. With that and other Spanish news stories, I'm joined by Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous. Liam, welcome to Midori House. Let's begin with the departure of Pedro Jota, who was the editor of one of the largest papers in Spain, and he's left under something of a cloud, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has, and he actually was dismissed. And this happened quite a few weeks ago, but it's been making headlines again because he did a televised interview on Sunday night with Jordi Evole, who's one of Spain's most crusading journalists. And he raised a lot of questions and conspiracy theories in what has been his style over the years in his own paper, basically claiming that he was swept aside because of his criticism of the government, which is raising a lot of questions about media independence in Spain.
Liam, Pedro Hot has been editor of El Mundo for more than 25 years. How has he shaped the paper's coverage over that time?
Yeah, he was also the founding editor, and he's shaped the media landscape, not only just the paper, by basically giving the Spanish media another center-right paper, not an extreme-right paper. There's quite a few of those, but he's kind of fashioned it like a tabloid. A lot of the time, El Mundo always went for the very punchy headlines and the kind of the scandals over the news sometimes. So if you wanted some more interesting or light reading, sometimes you'd go for El Mundo. But one of his best features features of his career was the breaking of the story of the GAL death squads, the government death squads, which were assassinating members of ETA. And this was a huge coup for the paper, and actually put him into a huge contest with the ruling socialist prime minister at the time. And the ruling social prime minister at the time was actually interviewed on the same show a couple of weeks ago, and he actually said, basically made it clear that one of his only enemies in the world was this editor, because they had such a horrible antagonistic relationship.
And what does Hotta's departure tell us about the state of media in Spain? Because this is, you know, he's not the only editor to be leaving under slightly suspicious circumstances. There have been a number of stories over the years about pressure that's put on Spanish newspapers to run certain stories and not run others.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the issue is that El Mundo has always been quite friendly to the PP, but over the last year, it's been quite critical of Rajoy, particularly during the Bárcenas corruption scandal. And Pedro Jota was famous for his very cozy relationship with former Prime Minister Aznar. They used to actually play tennis together at the headquarters of the paper, which also raises questions about media independence when the editors meeting up with the Prime Minister or the opposition leader when he was back then to play tennis. But because he's been so critical, Pedro Jota has basically said that there were some backroom dealings and the government has basically dropped all of its advertising in the paper, leading to millions of euros of losses of revenue. And a lot of the big major companies in Spain have also suddenly stopped advertising in the paper. So the board actually met and forced his departure, which he says, even though he's getting a multi-million dollar payout, he said he would give it all up in a day to keep doing the job that he loved.
Let's talk now about Mariano Rajoy, Spain's current prime minister. He's just had his State of the Union address. This is a little different from obviously the State of the Union in the US, which is a set piece event seen all over the world and tends to get a lot of people watching. Not that many Spaniards seem to watch the Spanish State of the Union, do they?
Yeah, no. Well, not this year. Only got about a 1.5% audience share. So it seems that the Spanish people are not just switching off from politics, but also switching off their TV when the politicians are on it. So the problem was that Rajoy talked for quite a while. He only dedicated the last 10 minutes to some positive solutions, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the poll numbers or the poll results after the State of the Union address, which also gives a right of reply for the opposition leader and some of the minor parties, actually put the opposition leader and Rajoy at about 30% approval rating. So not really cause to celebrate. But the positive measures that I mentioned earlier were basically, he's trying to talk up the economy and say that things are getting better, the worst is behind us, and he's offered a new flat rate, a social security rate for employers that hire new employees that keep them on for more than 2 years at just 100 euros a month for social security. So that's one positive measure currently being talked about in the papers.
Okay, and just finally, in your home city in Madrid, the mayor of the Spanish capital has an interesting stance, does she not, when it comes to the right of protest in the capital?
Yeah, she comes out with these thought bubbles quite often, and they always make the headlines because often she hasn't really thought them through much, but she's caught on mic, and a lot of the time her mind is trying to keep her away from the mics. But this time she actually said that she wants to ban protests in the city centre so they don't annoy businesses and tourists, which the climate at the moment, just to put a bit of context into it, is that Spain is currently debating a new citizen safety law, which the Interior Ministry wants to put into effect, which will basically make unauthorized protests fineable by 30,000 euros and also make it a fineable offence to offend the Spanish flag and interrupt public events. So there's a lot of controversy about any restrictions being put on protests at the moment, and Ana Botella has come out and put her two cents into the debate.
And to bring us all the way back to the beginning, Ana Botella is the wife of José María Aznar, the erstwhile tennis partner of Pedro Jota.
Exactly. So it's a little bit closed political niche. It's kind of everyone's kind of connected. The problem actually in the city council is that the ruling party has been in power for 22 years, so it's getting quite a bit stagnant. And there's talk about Ana Botella's replacement before the elections next year. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of news to come on the state of the Madrid City Council.
Liam Aldous, our correspondent in Madrid, thank you very much indeed. Up next, we ask whether the site of Pompeii is doomed or if Italy's new government can save it. You're listening to Midori House.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And you're back with Midori House, 1940 in Rome, 1840 here in London. It's a story we've heard before. Rainstorm damages the site of Pompeii. The world wonders if one of its most important archaeological jewels may soon completely fall into decay. Last Sunday and Monday, the walls of Pompeii crumbled again, threatened by red tape and heavy rains. Many structures have collapsed, and now the Italian government, the new government led by Matteo Renzi, says it will unblock €2 million of emergency funds to take care of Pompeii. But is it too late? We're joined now by Dr. Rick Jones, an expert in Roman archaeology who's worked in Pompeii for some 20 years or so. Dr. Jones, welcome to Midori House. Pompeii has been in a state of ruins for some time, hasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, it was first destroyed quite a long time ago. And so obviously we're looking at buildings that are already 2,000 years old and they need lots and lots of care. I think the present difficulties that have happened recently just show the importance of having good maintenance on the site.
Well, you mentioned good maintenance. I mean, I was last there about 3 years ago, and it was pretty shocking, really, to see that the graffiti, the stray dogs, it looked like no one was really taking care of it.
I think you have to go back a little bit further to 2008. Before that, the Italian authorities had been doing a pretty good job, I think, at trying to improve what was there. It's always a difficult job. It's always going to be hard. But in 2008, the unlamented Silvio Berlusconi declared a state of emergency. And since then, the administration has been in various levels of chaos. And I think that the intervention of the present government, the new government, seems to be trying to clear that through. And indeed, to some extent, the Letta government before was already making steps in that direction. So I think there's some grounds for optimism now that we may be getting back to a proper administration there.
Is part of the problem, obviously, Italy's finances and when you have lots of other things to worry about, perhaps looking after your culture isn't high up the list. And is part of it expertise?
Part of it, well, it's not so much the money. There's been money around, and the EU has put up a scheme of €105 million to help with the site. And this is really welcome. What's necessary is competence in the management and good administrative structure so you can get the jobs done. And that was happening. There were difficulties, and the problems of managing contracts was really hard. But they've been in some state of chaos for several years now. And that's created, I think, a mood of nobody cares around the site. And lots of people say the same sort of thing as you did. Now, I think if we can see a new initiative out of the new Minister of Culture and the new administration, then I think you can turn that around. It can be done.
You say it can be done. Are there other examples from either in Italy or elsewhere in the world where there have been similar problems and it has been turned around?
Well, it's hard to Pompeii is unique. I mean, of all the great monuments in the world, what you look at is stuff like the Taj Mahal or the pyramids are built by some great ruler or other. Pompeii is a city of a whole community. So there's lots of it all over the place. It spreads out massively, and it requires constant monitoring and attention. So there's nowhere quite like it in that way. And it just needs to make sure that the people there are properly organized and properly financed. And they're getting there. There are signs that you can bring that back. Most people know what needs to be done who are involved at the site. It's making sure that it can happen, and I'm cautiously optimistic that we can see it better.
We like cautious optimism. We like that. We'll leave it there. Dr. Rick Jones, an expert in Roman archaeology at the University of Leeds here in the UK. Thank you very much indeed. That was Pompeii. This sort of is Rome. It's more Chiba with Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. Rome Wasn't Built in a Day by More Chiba from the album Fragments of Freedom. Although I like that album. I love that album, but it's not quite as good as Big Calm. Although I was worried to discover that actually Big Calm is now 16 years old. Still, there we are. That was More Chiba. They're brilliant. Matt Wolf, he's rather good too. He's up next. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's theatre time. We're going to be talking musical theatre. We're also going to be talking serious theatre as well, don't worry. Matt Wolf from the International New York Times is with us. Matt, hello.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Very good indeed. Let's save the musicals.
Okay.
Let's save the musicals for the end.
Okay.
We've got... Oh, where should we start? I want to talk about A Taste of Honey, despite the fact I haven't seen it yet. But let's talk about a stage adaptation of a film classic, The Full Monty.
Yeah, which actually, interestingly, was previously adapted for the stage as a Broadway musical.
As a musical, indeed, but this is not...
This is not that.
No.
That was very American. It was set not in Sheffield, England, but in Buffalo, New York. This is set back in Sheffield. It's the plot you remember from the 1997 film, written by Simon Beaufoy, and the stage version is also written by Simon Beaufoy. It was his first film. It's now his first play. What they've done is really displaced the story of these six sort of economically desperate Sheffield steelworkers who decide, or it is decided by one of them, then the others join in, to become strippers in order to gain some cash and also to restore their self-esteem. And it's an interesting piece on stage because some of it, directed by Daniel Evans, is poignant, rather wistful, rather painful, as you realize the depths to which these six men have descended. But at the end of the day, the kind of galvanizing logic of the piece is about getting to this kind of would-be Chippendales-esque strip, which, just like in the stage musical, you don't actually see, sorry people, you don't actually see the full Monty. There's a blinding, you know, light and that's it. You're left to imagine it.
Okay. Well, I guess that's something. Or it's not something if you're...
It may not be much of anything, but we don't know.
Indeed.
Yes.
Now, is the fact that it's, you know, when it was first reproduced for stage, it was a full glitzy musical and there was, I think it's fair to say, a hen knightish aspect to the crowd.
I think that's still there. I was a little, although it has to be said, I went on a Monday. I was thinking to myself,
not a big hen night crowd on a Monday
night.
Well,
I wonder, Steve, what this might be like on a Friday night in the summer when everyone's been having, you know, some beers in the garden and are feeling rather merry. It's not quite as hysterical an atmosphere as there was at the stage version of Dirty Dancing, where I gather there were nights when the cast was, they had to come through the audience at one point, and there were nights where the cast was afraid to do so. But it does kind of whip the audience into a frenzy, but I think at this point it's a manageable frenzy.
Okay. Let's go from one extreme to another.
Yes.
Happy Days, which is not about the Fonz. It's certainly not a musical.
No.
It's Beckett.
Yeah.
And it's Juliet Stevenson buried in earth.
Yeah, I mean, not only is this not a play about somebody doing a striptease, it is a play about somebody who can't move. So far from taking their clothes off, they can't do anything. And in fact, one of the extraordinary things about the conceit of it is the way the immobility of it increases as the play goes on. So in the first act, Winnie, the Juliet Stevenson character, and her husband in the play, Willie, is also there. She's buried up to her waist in earth. And in the second act, it's her neck. And it's quite an extraordinary image of human entrapment. I mean, Beckett, the great existential playwright of the 20th century, and it's often not recognized, a great entertainer. His plays are not sort of academic theses there to be kind of decoded. They're very interesting visual images that are very arresting, wickedly funny. What is Winnie doing when she's up to her waist and up to her neck? She's not sitting there bemoaning her lot. She's actually, you know, fussing with her nails. I mean, when she can move her arms, opening a parasol, which admittedly does catch on fire, trying to call out to her ineffectual husband who can't quite get up to her. There's a lot of mordant comedy there. But at the end of the day, what is so galvanic about it is the contrast between her determined optimism. She keeps saying, tomorrow will be another happy day, and what we see as this kind of living entombment.
And how is Juliet Stevenson in this? Because in some ways you think, well, it's quite easy. You have very little to do. You can't move much. You know, any actor worth a salt must be able to pull this off. But it's tricky.
It is tricky. She's an actress I like a lot. I sometimes think, although I didn't hear, that she can be a little bit showy in her performances, a little bit self-conscious.
Hard to be showy if you can only move your eyebrows.
Yeah, right. She does do lots of sort of vocal flutters, but I mean, that's appropriate. And interestingly, she plays the character very sort of genteel middle-class English, not the Irish rhythms, of course, in which Beckett, who was Irish, wrote the play. And I think that's very nice because it sort of hits the English audience where they live. Certainly the women there and many of the men are thinking this could be us, metaphorically speaking. And that's because Juliet shows you a way into the humanity of the character.
Okay, very quickly before we move on to the musicals, A Taste of Honey, which is on at the National at the moment.
Well, another good opportunity for women. I mean, it's a defining play from 1958 written by the late Sheila Delaney, who in effect only ever really wrote one play. This was her play. She wrote it when she was 18. It's pretty grim, but again, flecked with humor about a mother and a daughter in Salford, and worth seeing, particularly, I think, for Leslie Sharp as the mother, an actress you know a lot from television, absolutely in her element on stage.
Okay. And finally, two musicals, one of which I'm fairly sure we discussed in our sort of a culture look ahead back in December over Christmas.
Probably.
You can't remember. This was
it's all a blur, Steve. It's a blissful blur.
The X Factor yes. musical, as I think everyone is perhaps calling it, called I Can't Sing,
right.
Which is finally actually opening now. Are we excited about the fact it's finally happening?
Or
do we wish that its budget problems would continue?
Well, no. I mean, nobody wishes ill to a musical that one hasn't seen. After you see them, you can wish them all sorts of things. But that's another story. We'll come back to that. But it's postponed 3-4, whatever it is, days worth of previews. And you always think, oh, God, what's going on? Is the set not working a euphemism for something else not working, which is more deeply embedded? Or maybe it's just the set. We will know on the 26th, 27th of March when it opens to the public.
Okay, and one other, I'm going to let you describe. Give us the title.
Yeah, why is everyone so squeamish about this? It's called Urinetown, and in the show...
But that's not your in
no,
town, is
it's
it?
Not. No, it's urine space, except there isn't a space in the title, town. And it's a place where, this is the musical speaking, Steve, not me, it's a place where people pay to pee. And it was a big hit in New York in 2000, 2001. It started grassroots off of Broadway, went on to be a Broadway hit. It's actually a show about love, radicalism, unions, and it's quite feisty. It's sort of the little show that could. absolutely the opposite end of the spectrum from Simon Cowell X Factor. So we'll see.
And do you think the fact that it's got this sort of quite sort of funny title kind of actually sort of detracts from the seriousness of the subject matter?
No, I think it's a wonderful seduction because it draws you and you think, oh, this is going to be edgy and kind of zany. And then when you're in there, you realize, ah, yes, but it's something more than that as well. So you get more than you paid for. Which is always good.
That is always good. That is always good. We always get more than we pay for with you as well.
Which is sweet. Thank you.
You can take that one or two ways, of course.
Oh, okay.
Matt Wolf from the
International. Good thing I'm not in the full Monty.
The International New York Times. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. That was today's Midori House. Thank you very much to my special guests, George Brock and Matthew Jameson, and of course, Liam Aldous in Madrid, and Matt Wolf here in the studio, thankfully with his clothes on. Midori House was produced by Daphne Denis. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma. Our studio manager was Bill Luty. Next up, after the headlines, if you're listening live, and if not, Don't forget, you can listen live. Next up, it's The Entrepreneurs, where we'll be heading to California to visit Liquid Space, the Airbnb of business property.
The idea was, there's all this available space that's out there in the world. Why don't we find a way to connect people to all that available space?
Indeed. Then at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, 1300 hours if you're on the East Coast. My name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.